We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
What we believe about the Bible is based on what we believe about its source.
The God Who Speaks, the award-winning documentary from the American Family Association, is now available in a special limited edition DVD set. This release includes a Sunday school curriculum and 2 hours of additional footage. Go to thegodwhospeaks.org to get your copy today. thegodwhospeaks.org. Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is February. Can you believe it? The long month of January is finally over, and today is Monday, February 3rd, and we are a few weeks into the new Trump administration, and it seems that Trump's executive orders are giving a lot more courage to Republicans to actually stand up and fight for the truth in things like there are only two genders. We should be able to say that in 2025. We should have said that for time immemorial, because since God created, there have only been two genders. But, you know, things that are just basic fundamental truth. And one of the things that the state of Texas is now standing up for is that Texas Governor Greg Abbott has signed an order to ensure that DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or the wokeness, is found nowhere in state agencies. And of course, the left is kind of melting down over this. And there is an influencer on the left who is probably legitimately one of the most just stupid people, frankly. And there's just no other way to characterize it in terms of, and I think that this woman just really has not thought things through and was kind of amplified as a very young woman without a lot of real thought and depth. And went viral yesterday over this because she's literally equating DEI to the ADA, or the Americans with Disabilities Act, and accommodations for disability. And so my question to a political reporter that responded to my response to this was, you know, are you all saying that women and minorities are now somehow disabled because you're equating the accommodations that are made through the ADA through to DEI? It's totally different. So this influencer named Olivia Juliana responded, and this was the viral tweet, in talking about Texas Governor Greg Abbott, says the man is literally disabled and in a wheelchair. DEI is literally the reason the Capitol building is accessible to him, which of course is just fundamentally stupid. Because, and this was my response to her, diversity and disability are not the same. Diversity is a variety of characteristics within a discrete category. I'll repeat that. Diversity is a variety of characteristics within a discrete category. Disability is a negative deviation from a normative standard of ability. I'll repeat that one. Disability is a negative deviation from a normative standard of ability. So DEI seeks to ensure diversity is represented without consideration of merit, whereas the ADA seeks to ensure disability is reasonably accommodated. DEI is not the reason that Governor Greg Abbott, who is in a wheelchair, can access the U.S. Capitol. And the ADA was there a long time before DEI and wokeness ever came on the scene. But let's welcome in our guest, who is Texas State Representative Brian Harrison, whose work in Texas really led to this victory. And he posted this January 31st, just one again, hours after posting my daily example of how the Texas government has been promoting and funding DEI. Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order ordering an end to it, DEI, in state agencies. I will not stop delivering conservative victories for Texas taxpayers. So good morning, Brian, and way to go on this. I want to find out more about what has led up to this and how Texas actually seeks to accomplish this, but then also get your response to the left's hysteria, you know, basically saying that DEI is the same thing as the ADI. I mean, I think that's preposterous.
Well, good morning, Jenna. Always great to be back with you. And maybe I'll go in reverse order on this. I actually had somehow missed the news you're talking about yesterday, people trying to, I guess, equate DEI to disability. And I'll be honest, I wish I hadn't heard you read all that. I think I lost a few IQ points just listening to such absurdity. There's, of course, no comparison between the two. And so it's absurd. But people, there's no link the left is not going to go to preserve their grip on one of the cornerstones of our society that I think they identified over a generation ago as a stronghold for them to indoctrinate and control the next generation, and that's our public schools and academia. And so for years, I've been on a crusade down here in Texas, as you mentioned, to expose the fact that the state of Texas, unbeknownst to a lot of people, has to the tune of many, many millions of dollars for many years been funding, supporting, and promoting leftist garbage like DEI, like LGBTQ liberal gender identity, ideology, transgenderism in some of our great public institutions, including my alma mater, Texas A&M. I helped pass a bill 2 years ago that purported to ban DEI, but because we have actually, and this is a whole other topic, we have a lot of liberal Democrat influence control over the Texas House of Representatives, which is this whole other topic. The Democrats actually control the Texas House. There are a ton of exceptions in the bill. And so I have been going for quite a while now. Every single morning, I go and get another example of where the Texas government is promoting DEI, you know, reverse racist policies, transgenderism. And I post them online, and I think was able to open the eyes of millions of Texans that were demanding action. If we're a conservative Republican state, it's embarrassing that, you know, for the last week or two, we're being outflanked to the right by President Trump, who I used to work for in D.C. And I just think, you know, Texas should be leading the nation in freedom, liberty, and conservative values. We've been coasting on that reputation for too long, and I'm very grateful to see Governor Greg Abbott put out this executive order, and now the legislature needs to codify it. And so happy to announce here on your show this morning, Jenna, that in just a few hours, I'm going to file a bill that will help legislatively codify some of Greg Abbott's executive order, and in fact is going to go further because we've got to use the power of the purse here. And so I'm going to file a bill in just a few hours that says to any of our public universities in the state of Texas, if you continue promoting DEI or liberal gender ideology, we are going to completely zero your budget from the taxpayers. If you want to promote liberalism, you do that with your own money, not on the backs of the overtaxed Texans who I'm proud to serve.
Absolutely wonderful. And I hope that that legislation passes. And we have a lot of AFR listeners here this morning that are joining from Texas. So if you are listening and you're from the state of Texas, call your legislators in Texas, encourage them to support this bill. And so do you have a name for it or a number yet, or will that be announced later so people can support your bill directly?
It will be announced very soon. I don't have the bill number for that bill, but I'll announce it on Twitter, and I'll shoot that over to you as well so folks can know what bill number to push for. Because Texans are, I mean, they're being taxed out of their homes. We actually have really high property taxes. But taxes that we take from people for the purposes of education, they're supposed to be just for that. They're supposed to be for education. The last thing they should be used for is for liberal indoctrination, and I'm not afraid to use the power of the purse and to zero out the budgets for any of these schools that are engaged in what I consider to be taxpayer abuse.
Amen to that. And using the power of the purse is so important, and I hope that members of Congress are listening today and will do the same, because they need to likewise codify President Trump's executive order so that we can have more enduring wins. And so, you know, Governor Greg Abbott is the longest serving incumbent governor. I mean, he's been there since 2015. When all of these policies have kind of gone systemically through Texas, what has taken this long to get to an executive order?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I think there was a lot of confusion when we did pass purportedly a ban on it in college 2 years ago. And I think a lot of people thought maybe in good faith that that ban had stopped it. But for anybody who's been paying any attention, they know that's just demonstrably false. I mean, my alma mater, who at Texas A&M, I'm a proud Aggie, but I have called now officially for the leadership of Texas A&M to be removed because they have allowed DEI and liberal indoctrination to propagate unchecked and metastasize all over that university. They have literal courses. I'm not making this up. Texas A&M has entire courses where they are training future government DEI staff. They have entire curricula and programs where they are training the next generation, literally, of social justice warriors. Just last year, A&M announced an entire minor, an entire undergraduate program, not just one class, but a whole minor in, quote, LGBTQ studies. The University of Texas has an LGBTQ studies minor. The University of Houston, the University of North Texas. This thing has this liberal indoctrination, this, as Elon calls it, the woke mind virus, this DEI, this liberal gender identity ideology. This has metastasized all throughout public education, even in the red state of Texas, and not just in our public universities, but in our K-12, our public schools. We have independent school districts, public schools all across the state of Texas that are hiring diversity, equity, and inclusion staffers, paying them $100,000 to $200,000 a year for the purposes of indoctrinating elementary, junior high, and high school students, and people's property taxes are what's being used to fund this. So in the state of Texas, we have had people, their tax dollars, hard-earned tax dollars, being weaponized against Texans, against their values, against their children. And Jenna, I have had it, and I'm going to do everything I can to stop this taxpayer abuse and to cut the budgets of any government entity engaged in liberal indoctrination. Quite frankly, we should have done it years ago, but I'm glad that the pressure that we've been applying is starting to yield some dividends, and maybe this is the year we can finally end this liberal taxpayer abuse.
Well, Representative Brian Harrison, my special guest this morning from the state of Texas, I wish that every Republican throughout the country was as passionate about this as you clearly are, because it is amazing how this has metastasized into all the crevices of our public dollars, institutions, and that people just take DEI somehow as fact, and that this is progress and this is leveling the playing field and all this, when it goes directly against the whole idea of meritocracy. It goes against the literal definition of the American dream. And for conservatives, which, I mean, Texas is a red state, to take taxpayer dollars to fund this, that actually makes me really mad, because as a taxpayer as well, it's, you know, not in the state of Texas, but obviously, you know, I live in Florida, but to see that, you know, sometimes I am against my will having to pay taxes that are then being used to support ideology that fundamentally goes against my sincerely held religious beliefs and just common sense. That's what's so frustrating about all of this nonsense that is being publicly funded, because if the state of Texas and other states had to actually ask the taxpayers, hey, do you support this? And this was some kind of proposition that they had to go out and seek funding for. There is no way that the average person in Texas or Florida, or I believe across the United States, would say, sure, we want to give our taxpayer dollars to fund these types of things.
No, you hit the nail on the head there, Jenna, and it's one thing that gets lost in the discussion. The left just wants to make it on, okay, do you support this stuff, which they claim is good, or do you oppose it? And by the way, on this whole issue of DEI, first of all, it's not a disability. That's complete insanity. But reverse racism is still racism. This isn't a progressive idea. This is perhaps one of the most regressive ideas that's ever been pushed on our society, and we need to rip this thing out root and branch. But you're right on the part that I said you hit the nail on the head on, that I want to highlight, is it's not just that it's a bad ideology that's out there that's making its way through the system. No. If you're a taxpayer in the state of Texas, not only is it being, are your kids being exposed to this because it's out there in society, it's out there in the culture, you are being forced to fund it by your government every time you pay your property tax bill, every time you pay your sales tax bill. What the government is doing with that money is it's handing it to a liberal Marxist professor who is then locked in a classroom with your children, and that is then indoctrinating them in the most dangerous, destructive, discredited Marxist leftist ideology. And as far as I'm concerned, the state of Texas, to the extent we should be involved in this at all, we should be leading the charge against leftism, against progressivism, against Marxism, against these facially racist policies. The last thing we should be doing is subsidizing on the backs of Texas taxpayers. It's a weaponization of Texans' own money against yes. their values, and it's past time for this to end.
Absolutely. Well, Brian Harrison, thanks so much. Follow him at Brian E. Harrison on X. We'll be right back with more. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we're talking about President Trump's wins and seeking to eradicate these ridiculous cultural Marxist ideology from within the federal government, and now the states, of course, are following that lead, at least some of the red states, and are doing that on the state level. There was an email that was sent from HR at OPM in the federal government, so the Office of Personnel Management in the government, talking, and the subject, interestingly, is fork in the road. And I want to read most of this email and then welcome in our guests to talk about this, because this is incredibly important. And to my knowledge, this is the first time this is being made public. So listen to this from OPM. During the first week of his administration, President Trump issued a number of directives concerning the federal workforce. Among those directives, the president required that employees return to in-person work, restored accountability for employees who have policy-making authority, restored accountability for senior career executives, and reformed the hiring process on the federal level to focus on merit. As a result of the above orders, the reform of the federal workforce will be significant. The reformed federal workforce will be built around 4 pillars. First is return to office, and then it goes into the expectations of that, which I'll skip over just for sake of time. Second is performance culture. The federal workforce should be comprised of the best America has to offer, goes into detail on that. Third, more streamlined and flexible workforce. 4, enhanced standards of conduct. And then it goes on to say, each of the pillars outlined above will be pursued in accordance with applicable law, consistent with your agency's policies, and to the extent permitted under relevant collective bargaining agreements. If you choose to remain in your current position, we thank you for your renewed focus on serving the American people to the best of your abilities and look forward to working together as a part of an improved federal workforce. At this time, we cannot give you full assurance regarding the certainty of your position or agency, but should your position abortion be eliminated. You will be treated with dignity and will be afforded the protections in place for such positions. If you choose not to continue in your current role in the federal workforce, we thank you for your service to your country, and you will be provided with a dignified, fair departure from the federal government utilizing a deferred resignation program. The program begins effective January 28th and is available to all federal employees until February 6th. If you choose to resign under this program, you will retain all pay and benefits regardless of your daily workload and will be exempted from all applicable in-person requirements until September 30, 2025 or earlier if you choose to accelerate your resignation for any reason. The details of this separation plan can be found below. So it outlines the deferred resignation program, and this is fantastic. This is basically, I mean, it's talking about the security of positions not being guaranteed. I think that is specifically talking about some of these DEI positions. You'll recall when President Trump first issued that executive order, the ATF tried to kind of stealth edit their chief diversity officer into just a senior executive and were called out on that. And so there is some of these some of these federal agencies that are trying to really have a hostile enforcement of President Trump's orders and keep some of their DEI in the federal government. But this type of program and this email that is just going out to all federal employees is really an excellent start. So let's bring in Ray Alexander, who is a retired Navy and has a lot of experience in the federal government. And Ray, this I think is fantastic. And for people who object to coming in to in-person work when their job actually requires it, there's a lot of people that can, you know, work from home with various reasons and accountability. But this type of thing is exactly what Elon Musk did for X. This is what the federal government should be doing. And I think this is a really good thing.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And thanks for having me on, John. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this because there's a lot of misinformation out there, mainly from folks that are oppositional to the current administration. And even in the workplace, you hear, like you mentioned, malicious compliance. Big picture, yeah, I agree. This is a great policy. I'm sure we'll get into some of the details and the kind of cascading effects of it as we approach the end of this fiscal year and then budgets for FY. Fiscal year 26.
Yeah. So what practical effect do you think this will have overall on the federal government? I mean, hostile compliance, you know, notwithstanding, and the federal government would have to deal with that separately. But overall, what does this look like for the federal government?
So interestingly unpredictable, I would say, is kind of a summary response to that question. But the interesting and useful, but unpredictable. So I think what'll happen is you'll have, I think I'm hearing estimates of 5 to 10% of the federal workforce will accept the deferred resignation, which creates holes. If you assume that those holes are created across the spectrum of government agencies, you'll have a lot of open, what we call billets or open jobs that are going to be kind of, well, they'll be filled until the end of the fiscal year, but that will give the government a lot of flexibility to realign its workforce. Basically, people are calling this a buyout, but if you know about appropriations law, then you'll understand that these positions are already funded through the middle of March and then are expected to be funded through the rest of the fiscal year with the next budget, with the FY25 budget. So the money has essentially already been set aside for these billets, for these positions. But once the next fiscal year hits, the money will, as the billets go away, or they may be sundown or abolished, the money becomes available for other requirements or for the other purposes, as do the billets if they want to maintain them. So it's a great restructuring tool. It's a great workforce restructuring tool, because it allows folks to voluntarily resign. And if the government had tried to instead do a reduction in force or first justify the loss of billets through restructuring, it would be a much more complicated and bureaucratic process, which is why I'm such a big fan of this. Basically, I'm a small government guy, having witnessed a lot of the inefficiencies in the government in my time, both in the military and then as a federal employee. I've always been a strong advocate for doing as much as we can with as little as with as little as possible. And instead of, you know, adding policies and adding processes and procedures, I've always looked for ways to streamline our operations and use existing policies or existing procedures to try to get more done. And, you know, this is a great opportunity for the federal workforce to be restructured in Donald Trump's vision and in Elon Musk's vision to make it much more productive for the American people, to get much more out of a single dollar than we have in the past.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that's a great way to look at it, that this is an opportunity to streamline the federal government and getting that in place rather than adding more processes and making this more complex of restructuring. And with these reformed, as the email terms, that the reformed federal workforce will be built around four pillars. And again, for listeners, this was return to office, performance culture, more streamlined and flexible workforce, and enhanced standard of conduct. Performance culture really sticks out to me, talking about insisting on excellence at every level, and our performance standards will be updated to reward and promote those, as the email says, that exceed expectations and address in a fair and open way those who do not meet the high standards which the taxpayers of this country have a right to demand. This, to me, goes to the heart of something that, as a taxpayer and an American citizen who has had to deal with the, the touch point in the forward-facing interface with the federal government, from, you know, whether it's Department of Ed to the IRS to, you know, a lot of different agencies, because the federal government doesn't have competition, then it doesn't really care about the customer. We're taxpayers. We're just... we're just citizens. We're not, and maybe constituents if you have an election and you're a politician, but there's really not a customer service or consumer mindset, because they really don't have to compete for the customer. They don't have to compete for business. The federal government is a non-revenue generating institution. They can just take our taxpayer dollars. So to me, performance culture is really a key. How do you view that component of the four pillars?
I absolutely 100% concur. And you see this, I saw this in the military, where as a battalion operations officer, I had various companies that worked for me at the company level. And I could create competitive incentives at that level with the companies that worked for me. If I had a couple of companies, for example, I had four companies that did essentially the same job, I would just be able to deploy them to different locations. I could easily compare the performance of those companies against one another and create incentives for that company, for those companies' leadership to do better. I could create milestones and metrics and performance points that could compete them against one another. And that was an extremely effective way to run that battalion. Once you get up to a certain level of government, there is no competitive. You can't develop those kind of competitive incentives. And so without existential threat of shutting down an individual organization or nowadays being fired, where you don't see that at all, without any top level accountability, which we've seen in government, absolutely the last administration for sure, where there's no existential threat coming from the performance level, and then there's no existential threat coming from the leadership level, there is zero incentive to perform. And so, and that's kind of a constant struggle with government. One of the things I think I read in, there was an interesting paper written by the CFO or the CEO, sorry, one of the leadership members of Palantir, wrote a very interesting 18-point basically white paper on how to increase that sort of competitive advantage and apply it on a government scale, specifically having to do with DOD and the quote unquote military industrial complex. And the basis of that, of his points, is essentially to create competition. And I'm 100% in support of it. It's something actually I've advocated in my military career since, you know, I recognized it as a junior officer, which is we need to create incentive. We need to create competitive incentives among our folks in order to provide some threat, or some carrot, some benefit to good performance and then some consequences to negative or bad performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm speaking with Ray Alexander, my special guest this morning. You can follow him on X at RMA1776. I encourage you to do that. And this is where I see President Trump, especially in 2016 when he first got elected, why the American people supported a venture capitalist, an entrepreneur, and someone who understands that market competition is a good thing and wants to see that same push for excellence in the federal government that is just a behemoth of antiquated technology and really lacking that customer service oriented mindset and that kind of that competitive drive. And I see that with Elon Musk. I see that with a lot of the people that Trump brought in, even in his first term. That was something that he wanted specifically to streamline. And I think he is going after this harder and quicker in his second term than he did even at the beginning, because he already knows where the pitfalls are. He's not kind of having this learning curve that he did in his first term. And that goes to the pillar four, enhanced standards of conduct. And this is where I think DEI is being called out, because when it talks about employees will be subject to enhanced standards of suitability and conduct as we move forward. Suitability is really meritocracy. And this means that you shouldn't get a job if you, just because you're a woman, just because you're a minority, just because, you know, you're LGBTQ or you check one of these other identifying boxes. It should be, if you are the best person for the job, you get it regardless of your immutable characteristics or your choice of sexual orientation and all of this other nonsense that the federal government has been so focused on. So let's talk in that vein about the hostile enforcement and the pushback of some of these federal agencies that are still helmed by people who want DEI.
So you'll hear of the big examples of malicious enforcement, say, for example, with that military organization that did that canceled the training on Tuskegee Airmen in response to the cancellation of DEI policies across the federal government. That happened a couple of weeks ago. And there are some other bigger examples of that kind of malicious enforcement. But I want to make sure your listeners understand that the more nefarious type of malicious enforcement happens at every single level of government leadership. So since this email came out, for example, right now I work for a government agency that provides logistics support for the military agencies. So that, you know, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, we provide logistics support for them. And in my job here, I'm exposed to wage grade employees, so, you know, lower level technicians, and I'm also exposed to kind of upper level management. And you could see first of all, as with any government bureaucracy, the word came down extremely. Management seemed to be caught off guard by it the morning of, and weren't prepared to brief. Not just weren't prepared to brief it, but weren't even prepared to inform the employees that this policy had been promulgated. And keep in mind that we have until Friday for these employees to make the decision on this. So even just that slow response that we're accustomed to with the bureaucratic organization is in and of itself a quasi, or at least we'll call it a micro malicious enforcement, where it's kind of incompetence that's causing the poor enforcement of this policy. And then once I happened to have the email ready and I knew it's important, so I read it to the group. And there was a whole bunch of employees who were curious about the opportunity, about taking the opportunity. And then you saw right away people who were, let's just say, opposed to the current administration became extremely skeptical and started asking questions that didn't necessarily even apply. But because of their skepticism, they began asking questions. And you see this now. A few days later, I listened to a Slate podcast on this morning, and there were representatives of the government on the line, and they were saying, one woman actually boiled down to just saying that she believes that this guidance is evil. So you're getting the policy itself is being interpreted by people who are oppositional to, who are just angry and who are just oppositional to the current administration, but who aren't investing effort in helping their employees understand what this opportunity offers. And so, you know, you have folks that are sharing their, you know, opinions that are informed by their political bias, giving guidance to employees all across the 2.3 million man government workforce. And when you read the email is extremely clear, and it's extremely straightforward. And one of the things that I love so much about this approach is it comes directly from OPM, guided by the President of the United States, to the individual employees. And that's what's so brilliant about this approach, is it shortcuts every single one of those bureaucratic hurdles from the president on down to the individual wage grade 4 employee. And it's clear, it's written in plain language. And all you need to do is respond with an email that says resign. And I can understand some skepticism in government. I am personally pretty skeptical. When COVID came around, I was doing my own research, because the irony, Jenna, if I could, do you have 1 second that I can make it a
sure.
parallel here?
Absolutely.
So what killed me about COVID is that no one was giving, we in the military are trained to make risk-based decisions. And so we want to get as much information as possible, as feasible, before making a decision. Obviously, that's dependent upon the decision timeline. And for COVID, the decision timeline was extremely long. We had months to decide if we were given the choice to take the vaccine. What boggled my mind was I was not being provided with mortality data and, you know, the research that supported the vaccine itself. And so I was very unfamiliar with being in a situation where I had to make a decision. I retained the right to make the decision, but I was given no information to make a risk-based decision. Here, we're given all the information in the email right up front, right at once. But folks who are opposed to the current leadership are making up information to confound the effort. So if you contrast this with COVID, we weren't given any information but told that we shall submit to the vaccine, not even given the choice. Here, we're given the choice and all the information up front, and yet there are intermediaries that are engaging in this sort of low-level, micro-malicious compliance who are sort of confounding or corrupting the overall effort. Sorry for the long explanation, but it stood out to me that the two different circumstances.
Absolutely. And that's the difference between leadership versus just requirement of compliance, and an authoritarian government versus a government that is truly seeking the best for America. And I love your contrast and explanation there. And Ray Alexander, and to my knowledge as well, I mean, this, as you mentioned, from the president and OPM directly to federal employees, and cutting out that bureaucracy is unprecedented. And it is such a way to skirt around all of the mid-level and higher up bureaucrats who would seek to thwart the good that this is accomplishing. So really looking forward to the outcome here. And thanks so much for your expertise and your opinions on this. Follow Ray Alexander on X at RMA1776. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And along the illegal immigration front and the crackdown, one of the top headlines over the weekend is that protesters shut down the Los Angeles freeway in response to ICE raids. This is coming from CBS. A large crowd gathered in downtown Los Angeles on Sunday in response to the recent increase in ICE raids and deportations. The protest initially began on Olivera Street, but grew to a few thousand people who marched to City Hall before walking onto the 101 freeway. And I'm just thinking, like, well, great, here's all of the people that Tom Homan can just come in and round up that are right there and basically self-identifying. But, you know, this is just so absurd that people who came here illegally think that somehow they have a right to stay in this country or to benefit from the United States in any way, shape, or form when they came here against our law. And the Fordham president sent an email expressing solidarity with illegal aliens in the face of the Trump crackdown. That's coming from Campus Reform as an exclusive. You can find it at campusreform.org. So the Fordham president compared illegal aliens to Americans who have lost their homes in natural disasters like the California fires. Ridiculous. President Tetlow wrote, quote, "I've struggled to write this message because it is not within my power to reassure those in pain." This is where the left always goes when they disagree with policy. They tug on the heartstrings and the emotion, and their emotional argument is not based in rationality or fact. And for a long time, Republicans have said, you know, we need to be more winsome, have more storytelling, have more emotion in our argument because, you know, facts are just facts and they don't convince those who are emotionally manipulated. Ben Shapiro, of course, says facts don't care about your feelings, and he's right about that. But often feelings don't care about facts. And for the left that is responding to all of the illegal immigration enforcement that the Trump administration in 2 weeks has already accomplished is purely emotional based. Because when they talk about, you know, oh, you're disrupting the lives of, you know, hardworking individuals who are here, who else are going to do these menial working jobs, their arguments are by and large totally emotional based or completely superfluous. They're not rational and they are not relevant to the issue at hand. And even when they try to talk about humanitarianism and all of these things, my question back is, well, what are the actual functions that government, especially the American government, but a national sovereignty that is built on a legitimate form of government, is actually supposed to provide to people, to its citizens in sovereign nations? When you have borders and you have a country, a government doesn't just exist without borders, without enforcement of law that is supposed to protect and preserve the people within its jurisdiction. The argument of humanitarianism conflates, ironically, the sphere of civil government with the sphere of church government or even individual citizens' action within civil government. Now, I as an individual can be humanitarian. I can give to organizations whose mission I prefer and want to advance, but humanitarianism from a government should be at will of the constituency, because again, like we've been talking about throughout this show, government is a non-revenue generating institution. Tax dollars should not be spent, taken from the people, and then spent on projects that the people do not consent to. It should be a willing and voluntary expense that people can give to. I mean, almost like a GoFundMe, right? If the government had to actually campaign or have campaigns for these types of projects, like giving humanitarian aid to other nations, that should be a voluntary request that people, individual citizens, can choose whether or not they contribute. Matt Walsh went viral last week for suggesting that the United States should end all foreign aid. And he said all means all, and then was called, you know, a racist, Jew-hating commentator because someone, of course, asked the emotional-laden argument, does that even mean to Israel? I mean, aren't conservatives pro-Israel? And he said all means all. And if a government or a nation can't operate, and I'm paraphrasing here now, but his response basically was, if a government of another nation can't operate because it relies so heavily on the goodwill of the United States and foreign aid, then maybe that's okay. And maybe they need to kind of, you know, restructure and rethink what they're doing. And then the argument, of course, was, well, then you're basically saying that Israel shouldn't exist. That is, again, an emotional, irrelevant argument. That is not at all what Matt Walsh was saying. He's saying if the consequences of ending all foreign aid, and we see the value and the advantage as a policy argument for ceasing foreign aid and actually spending taxpayer money on American citizens and enforcement of our own borders and things that the American people would prefer and assent to and contribute toward, and that results in some of these smaller countries having a little more difficult time, that's okay with Matt Walsh. And I would agree with that. That is okay. Because it is not our purpose here in the United States and our mission to take care of the world. Now, if you want to have organizations like, say, for example, Samaritan's Purse, or even Red Cross, or some of these others that go and give aid to different countries for a variety of reasons or in some specific circumstances, those individuals who contribute to those organizations are doing so willingly, voluntarily, and with informed consent. And this is the entire argument that a lot of Republicans and conservatives have made for a very long time. I mean, even since way before all of the bloat and bureaucracy that was the government, back in the 60s and 80s, but basically throughout the 20th century, when we saw so many of these programs, and especially with the 16th Amendment, where Congress can then lay and collect income tax. That's one of the worst ways that we have ever amended the U.S. Constitution, is to suggest that now the federal government can, against our will, take a portion of our income and then go spend it on whatever they deem appropriate without our consent. That is the number one reason, beyond just, all of the fiscal arguments and the fact that I want to keep more of what I earn. That's a biblical principle of property ownership, right? But even if we have some measure of taxes, that's a biblical principle. We pay our taxes. But what constitutes a legitimate tax is a totally different question. And when we are suggesting, and the federal government is suggesting, that they can take approximately 30 to 40% of our income, that's exorbitant, that's theft, and then go spend it on all of these programs that aren't actually benefiting the taxpayer. I mean, things like infrastructure and roads, things like the fire department, police, law enforcement, border security, those are things that tangibly benefit me as a taxpayer. I'm all for that. I will happily contribute to my local providers of those types of services. But when we're going and spending billions and billions of dollars abroad, and when we are actually suggesting, like, the president of this university, that somehow illegal aliens should benefit from all of the welfare programs that your and my tax dollars pay for, that is theft, and that is an emotional argument that completely, completely disregards the legitimacy of the purpose of what a tax genuinely should be. Now, because the government is not a revenue-generating institution, it has to have some tax, and that's the biblical principle that we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and we pay our taxes, and we understand the realm and institution of civil society. But what actually constitutes legitimacy is always, and I think purposefully, misunderstood by the left, who argue that because some programs are legitimate, then all programs are legitimate. And that is a false policy argument. And that is a logical fallacy, that to say because some programs are legitimate, all programs are legitimate. We cannot allow the left to encroach upon the legitimacy of government in all of the ways that they have been over the last, almost 100 years, basically. So this is a long time. I mean, this isn't just the last, 4 years of the Biden administration. This isn't just about the 8 years of Obama. This is also about some Republicans, even, who are unwilling to wind back a lot of the bloat in government because they want to spend your money as well. This is a uniparty swamp problem. And so when even Republicans in D.C. and in, some states even, but we're mainly talking about the federal government, when they want to tax and spend so irresponsibly, this is why fiscal conservatism matters. And this is why the enforcement of the border is tied into our fiscal economic policy. I mean, all of these things, having a holistic biblical worldview of the legitimacy of government matters. And so many people, and I've heard this from a lot of Christians, to say, why is economic policy and capitalism, how is that a biblical worldview? Because, other countries have, different varieties of their economic theory and all of this. But you have to go back centrally to what defines a legitimate government. And when a legitimate government is working to preserve and protect your and my rights as citizens of that specific nation, that are God-given rights, then we can work up from there in all aspects of policy as to what is legitimate and what is not. We have to ensure that we are not taken in by all of these emotionally laden arguments. We have to have facts, but even more importantly, we have to have a biblical worldview. So you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Have a very happy Monday, and I will talk to you tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.